What I've been wanting to do these last few years is on the first days of teaching of the year is to give talks on the Four Noble Truths. And I had in mind all year that I was going to do that this Monday. But then because of the earthquake in Indonesia, I had some thought that it's a huge event for the whole world. And remember after 9/11 we had several Sangha gatherings, community gatherings to discuss that or process that. And I know that there in other Dharma groups around the Bay Area that I know about a lot that had meetings last week, they somehow one way or the other addressed the earthquake and the impact of that. And in some ways it's addressing the first noble truth, the truth of suffering. And so I thought I would talk about it a little bit. I don't know how to talk about it, but I thought I'd talk a little bit and then we could have some discussion or we could questions about something else or whatever. I found myself last Sunday morning or Sunday afternoon heading up to Spirit Rock to teach a week-long retreat. And I was just beginning to get wind of that there was an earthquake and that several thousand people had been killed. And then that evening, we started this week-long retreat. And we mentioned it the opening evening. We have each evening at the end of the day of practice, we have what's called dedication of merit. We dedicate whatever benefit we've received from the day of practice for the welfare of others. And the first evening of the retreat, we did this, dedicated the retreat for the welfare of the people who had been impacted by the earthquake. And then the retreatants went into silence. And when you go on retreat, these kinds of retreats, you don't read the news. There's no contact, really, that kind of contact with the world outside. So the people in the retreat really didn't know what was going on. But the staff at Spirit Rock and also the teachers, us teachers, the four of us teaching, we kept track of the news as we went along. And one of the questions we had was, do we tell the retreatants? Because this was such a major event. And each day, it got more and more serious. It became clearer and clearer what was going on. And then one evening, one of the teachers did the dedication of merit little ceremony at the end of the evening. It was Wednesday evening, and he dedicated the merit of that day of practice to the people who had the victims of the earthquake and the tsunami. And then he mentioned in that, I think, how many people had died in different countries and what we knew at that time. And that was at 9:30, which is at, in the evening. After 9:30 in the evening is when people go to bed on retreats. So it might not have been a very skillful time to have told people, because some people were deeply shocked to find this out, and there were at least two people who had, couldn't go to sleep that night. They were so disturbed by this kind of news, and they didn't have a chance to process it or to do something about it. They just, were told and then sent to bed. So it's kind of, it's a little bit odd situation. But not everybody was there that closed that evening session. Maybe about half the group was there for the evening session. And so there's still probably half the group who hadn't heard. And so we come to Sunday morning when the retreat ended, yesterday morning. And it just didn't seem right to send people out into the world and see the headlines or turn on the news and find out for the first time the tremendous impact that this earthquake has had. So, and also when people leave retreat after a week of silence, there's what we often say, people are very open. They're very sensitive to the world and themselves and their feelings and everything. So it became particularly important for us teachers to kind of somehow take care of that or kind of meet people or somehow prepare people for what was in store. So But how do you do that? How do you introduce people to this, you know? So I gave, so it fell on me to do that little presentation. And so I want to say some of the things I said there, and then I want to say a few more things. It didn't seem right to just kind of lay out the facts of what had happened. Just, you know, just kind of saying, oh, and by the way, you fellows who've been sitting here, you know, 150,000 people just died last week, and there's probably more, and 500,000 people who are injured, and 5 million people who are homeless, and, you know, you could have gone through kind of that list. And that didn't seem right. So I started kind of slowly, kind of building to, I never said the figures, but I kind of tried to do it gently. And I started off by telling a story from the day before, where I had left Spirit Rock to go on an errand that I had to do. And I was driving down the Sir Francis Drake Boulevard. And the cars on both sides of the road behind me, in front of me, all pulled over to the side. As I looked in my rearview mirror, and there was a fire truck behind me with the sirens and lights on. And so I pulled over to the side. And then my I started tearing up. I started kind of feeling kind of really deep, kind of deeply touched. A kind of a sadness, but kind of a sadness that felt right, or kind of a, I mean, I wouldn't call it sadness, but I was deeply touched, moved by this. And it was a simple thing. But what I was moved by was that all these people, there was a need. There was something in some, supposedly when they have the sirens on, it means there's some they need to get somewhere to offer help. And that all these people moved their cars to the side to open the path and make it the path clear for the fire truck. So you might think I'm overly sensitive to cry at something like that. I didn't cry, but, you know, teared up. But I also had just left the retreat. But I thought it was quite beautiful. I was really touched and moved by the fact that people, you know, I gave people the best credit, thought best of them, and that everyone, you know, was very concerned and wanted to help. And it's kind of the best in human nature was coming out, where when there's problems, when there's people are suffering, people help. They get out, here in this case, they get out of the way and make it possible for the emergency vehicles to get through. And then I mentioned the earthquake. But what I mentioned first was that in the United States, I think as of what I could gather by Sunday morning, private citizens had donated $100 million to relief efforts in there in the Indian Ocean. And that seemed quite impressive. And I was very, very moved by that, that such outpouring of support so quickly, even before the president asked for it. I know people who their first response Monday morning, you know, they got a sense of what's going on Sunday, and Monday morning they sent checks to the American Red Cross and different places to offer help. And in Britain, as of yesterday morning, I think there were something like $35 million that private citizens had donated. And I was really impressed by that, this outpouring of goodwill, people's compassionate response to the suffering in the world. So my way of introducing the magnitude of what had happened was not to go through the facts and figures of what had happened, of, you know, the harm that the tragedy that occurred, but rather to talk about the compassionate response. And magnitude of the response, you know, was then a mere reflection of the magnitude of the problem. But that was the way to introduce these retreatants to what was going on, what had happened. And I'm very inspired by the response that many people have had all over the world. And some people that kind of in our own extended community were affected. There was one person who, some of you might know, Franz, who was a manager and cook for many retreats, taught at Spirit Rock retreats. And he was on the beach in India when the tsunami hit there. So we got an email from him and saying that he saw that he was doing Qigong on the beach, and he saw the wave coming. And so he ran up the top of a wall and up into a tree and held on tight, and then prayed as the water rushed over him. And he said his mind became very clear. And it was a very brief kind of telegraph, kind of email, because he mentioned all the death that was, I guess, all around him. So what do you, you know, he was just telling people he was okay. And then Steve Smith, who's a Vipassana teacher, was in Thailand at the time. And I don't know what he was doing there. I don't know if he was in any danger himself. I have a feeling he wasn't. But his response was to go to the place on the coast of Thailand where people had been victims and people had died, and was helping with pulling out bodies, finding bodies. That was his response, to go down there and do that. And I was really happy to hear that, and kind of, in a sense, I don't know if pride is the right word, but proud or happy, that because I feel that one of the things that mature Buddhist practitioners can offer is the ability to go into situations of great distress, even when there's, you know, finding bodies, bloated bodies, and have the ability through the deep Dharma practice of dealing, confronting impermanence, confronting suffering, learning how to work with it, to be able to go in and be of service in situations where maybe other people who haven't developed themselves would maybe feel just too much distress or fear or horror and wouldn't be able to stay present for those kinds of events. So my own kind of response, or my own thoughts around this kind of event, is to focus mostly on the response. This is what I talked about in the retreat. But also, that's my own personal kind of first line of approach. You know, what's the response going to be? And that this is where, you know, kind of the responsibility, or where we have a responsibility, ability to respond, the place where it's our, you know, where our practice is expressed in the world, or our good heart is expressed in the world, is in how we respond to the world around us. And then to focus on that. And that's really kind of maybe the key thing that Buddhism points to, is taking responsibility for our ability to respond, to study that, to understand that, and in some ways take refuge in that, or find support in that, and act on it, act in the world, rather than being paralyzed, or rather than being lost in fear or distress or horror, or many things that are so easily possible in this kind of situation. There's one of my favorite theistic stories, God stories, that is a story about a person who died and went to heaven. And the person went up to God and said, you know, complained. Because, you know, the world's a mess. All these people are suffering, and there's wars and earthquakes and all these terrible things. And you should be doing something about it. And so God said, I did do something about it. I made you. So not to put the responsibility somewhere else, on some other place outside of us, but in some sense, find where we take responsibility ourselves for you know, where is our response, our ability to respond? Where do we take care of things? What do we do? Not that we're responsible for the whole world. You know, we can't fix it all. But as individuals in this vast sea of humanity, where's our response? How do we? And that's why I was so inspired by all these individuals who, unprompted, you know, so many people unprompted send out their donations to, you know, different charities, and it was such a beautiful thing. So in terms of then looking at the response, which is a very key aspect of Buddhist practice, you know, what is a response? And there's two aspects of response. One is that aspect that has to do with how we react to it, what happens inside, what wells up inside of us, and then what we actually do acting on it. So what wells up inside, it can certainly be horror and distress and fear, many different strong feelings. And part of Buddhist practice then is to learn to be present for those, so we can be present for them in a wise way. So wisdom has a chance to mature and grow in a certain way of being present and honest that we're having these feelings. If we haven't learned the skills of honest presence to those things, then it's all too easy for those things to kind of be in the background, kind of off stage, directing our show, kind of pushing us around, or keeping us paralyzed, or keeping us in a mode of complaining. Complaining is really popular. One of the nice, but one of the aspects that struck me about the earthquake, I've heard a lot of people distressed about things in the world and the nation over the last months. And usually it goes together with a sense of complaining. But with the earthquake, you can't exactly complain. I mean, it isn't like someone, you know, they had a vote and someone then rigged the vote, or, you know, or some other people made a decision or about the earthquake. Just, you know, you can't exactly complain about people doing it. So here's a very painful and distressing situation where the complaining doesn't actually make as much sense as it does when you can point blame. And so then again, it becomes very important, this kind of the blaming also, or complaining, is a way of detracting sometimes from finding the place where we're able to respond and to act in the world. And so this God story, the guy was complaining to God. And God said, well, I made you. Don't complain. It was up to you to do something. And so part of practice is to really look at the feelings, the emotions that arise, and to understand they're workable. There's something we can practice with. We can bring certainly compassion to ourselves. We can bring presence to ourselves. We can explore it. We could not let them have the upper hand by having a strong sense of presence that we develop in the midst of it. And sometimes it takes a long time, months or years, of something like a meditation practice or mindfulness practice, to have the ability to stay present wisely for some of the most difficult emotions that the person can experience in times of distress. And I imagine, I don't know Steve Smith, you know, going there collecting bodies, what his emotional life is like. But I know that he's spent years cultivating and developing himself, in a sense being ready to be able to do something like this. A few weeks ago, I had a conversation with a priest, one of the senior teachers at the San Francisco Zen Center. And she's been there for a long time, and maybe it's getting time for her to leave Zen Center after many years of living there and practicing there and being a teacher there. However, Zen Center doesn't have a severance package, or doesn't have they don't have a retirement plan for monks. And she always knew that. And that's not, she didn't join Zen Center to, you know, have benefits. She became a priest or a monk, a nun, in order to try to practice as deeply as she could, and then also to take her compassion and concern for the world and live it in the world around her. So I was having a conversation with her. I was a little bit concerned about her leaving, and I was wondering how she could take care of herself, and I was going to see if maybe I could help or do something, because I knew that she wasn't going to, didn't have much money or any money. And so she was very frank and honest with me. I was really struck by the honesty. You ask someone very personal questions like that. But one of the things she said to me really struck me was, it's true that I don't have much money to leave Zen Center, and I don't know what's next in store for me, what's going to happen. These 25 years of training were all about this. 25 years of training were, if I don't have the ability to be homeless and be happy or be contented or to keep my peace, then my training hasn't really been worthwhile. Her years of training was to face a situation of great distress or great challenge and be able to do it with wisdom and compassion and peace. So that, you know, that was a very powerful statement, that, you know, that she's been training herself for that. I think of that, you know, Buddhist training is a training for, among other things, it is a training for the times in our lives when things are, you know, overwhelmingly challenging, which happens to most people sooner or later. People we know die, or you're going to die, I think, at some point. And so that challenge, you know, sometimes it's a real challenge to die, because I guess if it's really quick, it's not so challenging. But if it's slow, you know, it can be quite a big deal to deal with. And so to be preparing ourselves for that. Sometimes people come to retreats or meditation, and one of the things they ask is, why should I sit with physical pain? Or why should I sit with any pain? I mean, I could just go and, you know, I could leave. And once on a retreat, you know, I do as a teacher, I do these interviews, you know, so with people, every couple of days they have an interview with a teacher. And it's a short interview, 15 minutes, and usually they're very nice. And so it was at Spirit Rock teaching, and this guy came in for his interview. And usually you talk about what your practice has been like over the last 24 hours. And this guy said, today I just came back from a round of golf with a neighboring golf course. And I thought that was rather unique for these silent retreats. Some of you maybe, you know, wish you thought about that. And So there are options to sitting with, you know, other options besides sitting with your pain. You can go to the golf course. And I've known people who were sitting Zen 7-day Zen, in the middle of it, I went to the movies. And then came back. So there's many ways of practicing. So there are ways of kind of, you know, keeping us from staying present with difficulty. Or sometimes in retreat, there's easier ways. You can always just change your posture, or you can do all kinds of things. So people ask, why should I stay with the pain or the difficulty? And there are certainly wise reasons for not staying with pain, and there's also wise reasons to stay with it in retreat. Even when pain is optional, it can be seen as a training. When it's safe to be with pain, you're not damaging yourself, then it's a training to learn about our reactions, our responses, our emotions, our thoughts, our beliefs. There's so many things that go on that complicate the situation when we're in pain, that augment and exaggerate or magnify our suffering. And if we take a situation that's relatively safe where we have to feel pain, and to stay with it and work with it and really investigate it really thoroughly, and to learn all the different ways that we tick around it, all the way in which we react to it, then when it becomes much more real, when it's not optional, when the pain is, you know, this is, you can't get away, then you're already familiar with yourself really well, and so that you can enter that situation with more calm and peace or wisdom or a useful way, rather than getting lost in the reactivity that might happen. So, but then in terms of responding to the suffering of the world, I think there's two primary directions that response can take. One direction is external. You know, if there's suffering out there, to try to meet that, try to help in some way or other. And the other way is internal, to move in. And both responses are very significant and I think important to understand. The external one, you know, if someone, neighbor is in distress, a neighbor is sick and whatever, it's pretty normal to go help the neighbor, bring some dinner or go shopping or do whatever. And if the situation is larger than that in the world, I think that people will often offer other things. The compassionate response, I think, is not just a good idea. I believe, and this is a belief, maybe it's not true for everybody, I don't know how, you know, the psychophysiology of human beings varies from person to person. But I believe that, you know, for most people, that the compassionate response is something which is innate in their hearts. And that not to allow it to come forth when it's been aroused or struck is diminishes ourselves, limits ourselves. You know, it's a kind of violence to ourselves. When we allow it to come forth, you know, we're not holding ourselves back, not numbing ourselves or shutting something down. But and in addition, we're actually allowing something beautiful to flow through us, something that's healthy. I think the compassionate response in and of itself is a healthy response. I read recently that when people have a compassionate response, the human body releases oxytocin. You know that? And oxytocin is released in different kinds of situations, but one place it's released in is when mothers are nursing. And one of the effects oxytocin has apparently on the system, it soothes us and calms us. And it makes some sense, because if you're going to respond compassionately to someone, you're there to calm and soothe them. So you want to be that way, right? So the, you know, if you're full of fear and distress and anxiety, it's very hard to kind of meet, even, you know, even if you want to help someone, it's kind of like a little bit mixed messages then, or, you know, your presence is not maybe so helpful. So you know, things happen physiologically in our body that are very powerful and healthy with the compassionate response, it seems to be. The ability to act compassionately has a lot to do with how well we know ourselves and how well we're able to work and work with our distresses and our fears and anxieties that do arise. So one response is the external response, to act in the world. And if the situation, if the tragedy in the world is really big, or the tragedy in our life with our neighbor is really big or something, I think that, and we don't respond, I think the bigger the tragedy is, the more violence we do to ourselves, if there isn't some kind of response. But it doesn't have to be an external response. There's a second response, and that's the internal response, the way we respond going in. And what I mean by this is this movement to take the situation and to use it to motivate us to purify our own hearts, or to practice for ourselves, to get down to the roots of our own suffering, our own greed, hate, and delusion, our own clinging, and clarify it and purify it and work with it. When there were some members of our community who left right after 9/11 to go sit a 3-month retreat at IMS, before they went, I went and found them and said, I don't know what you're thinking, you know, about leaving and going now, but I'd imagine that some people would think that this is much too self-centered or selfish or inappropriate to go off on a retreat right after 9/11 when we don't know what's going to happen. There's so much distress and such big anxiety and so much big problems. And I said, but I want to reassure you that I think that it's one of the most powerful responses to something like 9/11 is to go and sit a 3-month retreat. We need some people in the world who go and are trying to purify their hearts at the depths of their hearts, which I think what happens on these long retreats. We need to have some people show that it's possible to do that kind of deep work. And if it isn't possible to purify the heart in deep ways, then we're all lost. You know, so someone has to do it. And so I think I see that as a very powerful response. So they weren't going to New York, they weren't helping in that kind of external ways, but their way of helping the world was to go internally and work on themselves in a sense. And hopefully the contact with suffering was a very healthy source of motivation to really apply themselves, really try hard for the sake of others, for the benefit of others, but the movement was inwards rather than outwards. And there are many situations where there's suffering in the world and it doesn't make sense for us to respond directly. You know, most of the suffering we're not going to address it so much. So, but we can be motivated by that. We read the newspaper and we find out what's going on in Uganda or anywhere else. We can be motivated by that. It doesn't have to paralyze us or discourage us that we can't respond. We can be motivated by that, and that motivation is, for example, can be turned inwards to practice. In our practice, I'm going to practice harder, more diligently. Or it can have motivation, it can be flowed. I can't go to Uganda, I can't go to Sri Lanka, but that I'm really motivated. I'm going to help in a local soup kitchen. I'm going to take that motivation and help locally in some situation. So there's many ways of responding, externally and internally. The Buddhist tradition, as a practice tradition, has the most to say about the movement inward. I believe the Buddhist tradition says that both are equally important, the external response and the internal response. But what Buddhism has developed over the centuries is a lot of skills and understanding about how to go in and do this inner work really well. And that's kind of the strength of it. And then you come from there and go into the world, hopefully. And in the Zen tradition, they talk about returning to the world with gift-bestowing hands after doing this work. So then there's a wonderful mutuality that goes on, that you know, the practice within, in a sense, is a support for our able to practice without. And our contact with the world without and our receptivity to the world without is then support for being able to go within. And they kind of go round and round. They go together. So, in the midst of all this tragedy, I think it's been really important that we're watching and witnessing one of the largest relief efforts in the world ever. And I don't think that it's just kind of abstract institutions that are doing that relief work. It's really the expression of collective will and good heart of countless millions of people in the world. And so I think it's important, I think, also be inspired and be encouraged by that collective goodwill. And I think it's also important to find that inspiration within your own heart, in the ability of your own heart to respond instead of complaining or whatever, or numbing. So those are my thoughts, my attempt to try to say something appropriate. Anything anybody would like to say? We could pass the mic.
I was inspired to read a web page by Joanna Macy, if you just Google her. And she's got an open letter about the situation and one simple place to click and send things off for relief in Sri Lanka. And I was looking for a site that was a little removed from the institutions that we know about, because some writing that I was looking at was from someone who said that most of the people don't trust government relief, and they're interested in individual donations that go directly to the people without a lot of overhead. And that is the site that Joanna is talking about. And I don't know if you all know who she is, but she's a longtime Buddhist practitioner and has done a lot of work in Sri Lanka. So I sort of put a lot of trust in what she has to say about the situation there, and I trust the site that she sent people to. Joanna Macy.
You have to turn it on. Underneath, yeah.
Hello. There we go. I just wanted to say I found it really helpful to listen to your talk today. I found out about it. I was staying down at my mother's house, and my mother tends to catastrophize things and get very, very dramatic, and she'd watched all the news footage, and I'd woke up first thing in the morning, and she was all of a sudden retelling all these horrible stories of tragedy, you know, that were very personal. And I just completely shut down, and I decided I didn't want to read the papers. I didn't want to look at TV. I didn't want to be so overwhelmed with that feeling of bleakness and hopelessness. But by doing that, it is a numbing out, and it is a denial of reality and what's going on around you, and that has a cost too. So I'm just very grateful that you've helped frame it in a way that I feel I can sit with a situation and not be overwhelmed by bleakness. You seem to frame it in a way in which there's hope, and you're seeing it in a positive light. So
great.
I thank you for that.
Thank you. Well, Ben, may whatever benefit and merit that has come from our practice here this evening, may it be dedicated for the welfare and well-being of all the people, all the beings who have been affected, harmed by the earthquake, and may our practice be somehow, some way or other, seen and unseen ways, spill over directly and indirectly to help alleviate the suffering of those people. So thank you all very much.